Good morning. Welcome to our worship service at Theodore Parker Church. My name is Joel Nitis. I've been coming to church now for just about 4 years to Theodore Parker. I'm on the ministerial search committee and in the past have been on the membership committee, the social action committee, and the music and worship committee, all of which are very satisfying and wonderful activities if anyone is interested in participating. If you're visiting for the first time, we extend a special welcome to you. Our congregation gathers from a variety of perspectives and religious backgrounds. We come together to learn, to explore religious ideas and moral questions, to grow spiritually, and to care for one another and for our larger community and world through works of service. Wherever you are on your religious journey, whatever your belief or doubt, your culture, color, or background, sexual orientation, gender identity, or financial circumstances, everyone is welcome here, and we're very glad you've decided to join us today. You'll see in the pew rack in front of you a welcome booklet, which you're invited to take with you, and a yellow card. If you would like to know more about Theodore Parker Church or receive our weekly electronic bulletin, you can fill the card out and place it in the collection plate when the offering is taken. Please join us for coffee hour after our service. Follow people through that door through the breezeway and into the parish hall. Newcomers can look for the welcome table hosted by our membership committee at coffee hour, and everyone who has remembered to wear their name tags, very good. Not me. Somehow the person who stands up here every week is the one who forgets to do that. Now would be a good time to turn off your cell phone or other electronic devices. Take a moment to look at the announcements in the leaflet insert, and we can take brief announcements from the floor. Robin? Thank you. Tori, did you have an announcement? Gretchen. Stanzi. John. Dexter. Thank you. Tori. Okay. Yes. John. Thank you. The prelude is based on a traditional Jewish New Year melody. Thank you.
gather in worship to be called to our best selves, to open our minds and our hearts that we might be understanding and accepting of differences, and that our souls might know forgiveness and mercy. In these solemn days of awe from the Jewish tradition, may we too be introspective, reflecting on the thoughts and the deeds of our own lives.
Today we base our service on the Jewish high holidays. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, was celebrated last week, and Yom Kippur, a day of fasting and prayer known as the Day of Atonement, is next Wednesday. Our service falls in the middle of what are known as the Days of Awe, or the 10 Days of Returning. The prelude was a traditional melody for a prayer from the High Holiday Liturgy. I offer you this fairly tight paraphrasing and abridgment of that prayer from the traditional prayer book, and a taste of the spiritual and the spirit and theme of the Jewish high holidays. The prayers go like this. On Rosh Hashanah, the book of life is opened, and at the end of Yom Kippur, the book is sealed, and it is determined. How many shall pass away, and how many shall be born? Who will live, and who will die? Who shall finish their allotted time, and who will not? Who shall be at home, and who will be displaced? Who will remain tranquil, and who will be disturbed? Who will enjoy life, and who will suffer? Who grow rich, and who be impoverished? Who will fall, and who will rise? But teshuvah, repentance, and tefillah, prayer, and tzedakah, charity, can soften the harshness of our fate. For me, the primary message of this prayer is the need to be mindful of the fragile and unpredictable nature of life. It's a call for humility over arrogance, for modesty over an inflated or unrealistic sense of our own importance. As Rosh Hashanah is also regarded as the birthday of creation, it's a reminder that all creation is a gift and a miracle, and not simply the raw material for our consumption. The last line of the prayer seems to offer some optimism that we may be able to influence our fate. The chief rabbi of England, Lord Jonathan Sacks, teaches us about the meaning of the last line of the prayer, which he asserts is commonly mistranslated from the Hebrew as repentance, prayer, and charity. He teaches that tshuva is not repentance, but literally means returning, and refers to turning away from material distractions and returning to our central core of goodness. He teaches that the word tefillah is not prayer, but is properly translated as connecting with the source of all life. And tzedakah is not charity, but righteousness and justice, and that right action in the world is the responsibility of each of us. Perhaps holding to these three principles in our lives can alter our fate. Please rise for the first hymn, 350 in your gray hymnal. please remain standing for the chalice lighting?
May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom. Please be seated.
So today we welcome the participants in the Religious Exploration Program to be with us in the big church. And we're going to participate in the Tashlich ritual, which a lot of us are familiar with because it's become a custom here at this service to enact this ritual. So on the high holidays, we remember that in spite of our best intentions, we can frequently miss the mark. That is, we're not always on our best behavior, and we don't always follow through on our commitments or keep our promises. On the afternoon of the first day of Rosh Hashanah, Jews enact the Tashlich ritual by the side of a stream. Can we have the stream? The stream is flowing now. And we cast off. The meaning of Tashlich is casting off. We let go of times we've missed the mark. We throw breadcrumbs. Is there a breadcrumb holder? and somebody from RE, like... Yeah, they should all come. So we throw breadcrumbs while we recite a prayer, and a reading is going to accompany this ritual. And we're going to invite members of the congregation to maybe think of moments during the last year that you weren't at your best and that you'd like to let go of, and come forward, maybe in the middle, and we'll have a basket of bread that you can cast in the waters here and relieve yourself of the burden of maybe you weren't always so good this year. So that's it. So please come forward. The reading.
Yes.
Want to do that simultaneously? Go ahead.
On this sacred day when the old year slips away and we prepare to meet the year ahead, we stand at the water's edge, our pockets lined with dust and bread, symbols of our shortcomings and regrets.
Many are the regrets and sorrows that weigh upon our souls. Let us cast them off into the morning water, so we may begin anew.
Great is our regret for the harsh words spoken, the tender words left unsaid, for the answer that smoldered, the compassion withheld. From our greed and jealousy, our lack of generosity, for all that we could have done, all that we could have left undone.
Many are the regrets and sorrows that weigh upon our souls. Let us cast them into the morning moving waters, so we can strive to become all that we are to be.
Great is our remorse for the energy we spent fighting instead of trying to make amends, for the times we could have lent a hand, but kept our hands at our sides, for the times we looked away from those near and far,
who needed our help and caring when we turned away from the places in need of repair.
Many are the regrets and sorrows that weigh upon our souls. Let us cast them into moving water so we can begin to build bridges connecting us to one another.
So now if people feel moved to come forward and take some bread and drop it in the stream, please do so.
Let's read together responsive reading number 637 in the back of your hymnal, a litany of atonement. For remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference. For each time that our fears have made us rigid and inaccessible. For each time that we have struck out in anger without just cause. For each time that our greed has blinded us to the needs of others. For the selfishness which sets us apart and alone.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For falling short of the admonitions of the Spirit.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For losing sight of our unity.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For those and for so many acts, both evident and subtle, which have fueled the illusion of separateness.
We forgive ourselves and each other, and we begin again in love.
Our free will offering is a visible symbol that we are not indifferent to one another. This morning's offering will now be given and received for the good work of this congregation. Thank you.
Excuse me, I have too many pieces of paper. I'm sorry. Okay. Way too many. Oh, my goodness. Sorry about that. The Tashlich ritual on Rosh Hashanah, along with the custom of actively making amends with people between the holidays these days, and also participating in the Kol Nidre service at the start of Yom Kippur, are all opportunities for us to let go of times when we were not our best selves and rededicate ourselves to those principles I mentioned before, teshuvah, tefillah, tzedakah, for the coming year. We have a chance to let go, forgive ourselves and each other, and move on. The music for the meditation is the melody from the iconic Kol Nidre prayer. And first, I would like to offer you this poem, if I can arrange my papers properly. Okay. This is a time for meditation, and I'm sorry to disturb the mood. I will read the poem, and then Yukiko will play the melody. It's called Aspiration. What matters isn't who I am during the service, but who I am when I've come home to the cat and the bills, to-do list as long as the yoga mat I too rarely unfurl. The real work is living my intentions at my desktop, the laptop open, in a slow-moving line at the grocery store past screaming tabloids. When someone I love loses a job or a partner or a body that works, Elul, this moon cycling its phases before the days of awe, is a string on my finger to fill in on my arm, a winding reminder that I don't need the addictions of ego or self-importance. Every instant is a new year, a new chance to bear again in mind that every sunrise is the light of creation in sweet reprise, and every moment is a prayer I'm blessed to be able to recite.
It's been said that if given enough time with a typewriter, a monkey will eventually write Hamlet. Jonathan Gottschall, who is the author of the new book, The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human, says that's pretty much what happened when a band of less hairy primates split off from the first crew of bipeds, and eventually, well, one of those primates did write Hamlet. He goes on to say, tens of thousands of years ago, when the human mind was young and our numbers were few, we were telling one another stories. And now, tens of thousands of years later, when our species teems the globe, most of us hew strongly to stories about the origins of things. We thrill to the great varieties of fiction, murder stories, sex stories, war stories, conspiracy stories, true stories, and false. As a species, we are, he says, addicted to story. And even when the body goes to sleep, the mind stays up all night long telling itself stories. This morning's sermon is full of stories. I'm going to tell you the story of Jacob and the angel. I'm also going to tell you about a rabbi in California. And finally, I'm going to tell you the story of a young female writer named Emma Forrest, who struggles with demons to stay alive. I'm going to tell you their connection to each other and to us. But first, the story of Jacob, which comes from the book of Genesis in the Hebrew Bible. It's often the text used in synagogues for the High Holy Days. You may remember, as the story goes, that Isaac, the son of Abraham, had twin boys. And even though they were born just minutes apart, as twins typically are, Esau, being the firstborn, was the older brother and Jacob the younger. This birth order caused friction between the brothers over the birthright, which eventually resulted in Esau selling his birthright to his younger brother. Actually, he sold it for food. Complicating things even further was the blessing that Isaac, in his old age, intended to give to his oldest son, but was tricked by Jacob into having his father bless him instead. Esau, as we might imagine, was enraged by this betrayal. He threatened Jacob's life, and so, in the heat of this family crisis, Jacob does the cowardly but sensible thing and flees to the safety of his uncle's house in another land. The drama continues when Jacob becomes engaged to marry Rachel, his uncle's younger daughter, only to discover on his wedding night that he has been tricked into marrying her older sister. And what does Jacob do? But a week later, he makes a deal with his uncle that allows him to be married to both daughters. I think it's remarkable to realize that the Hebrew Bible is about 600 pages long, or at least my RSV Oxford version is, and all of this happens before page 35. So Jacob continues to live with his uncle and two wives for the next 20 years, but then finally sends word to his brother that he wants to come home. And it's on this trip home where he has the famous encounter with the angel. The passage begins, "And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of day. When the man tried to break free, Jacob said, 'I will not let you go until you bless me.' And when daylight came," the verse continues, "the man said, 'Your name shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.'" Rabbi Volpe of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles interprets this story for his congregation by saying the most salient aspect of the Jacob and the angel story are these four words: Jacob was left alone. So if that's so, Then who was he wrestling with all night? And whose blessing was he asking for? We know the answer because we know from our own lives with whom we struggle. The greatest struggle of all is the struggle we have with ourselves. It's a struggle to feel loved, to feel accepted, to feel good enough, to feel worthy in spite of the mistakes we make and the regrets we have. And sometimes we struggle just to get through the day and to believe in tomorrow. The power of this story for Jacob and for us is that at the end of the long, dark night of the soul, Jacob is different. And here's the thing. He's not different because someone or something happened to make him different. He's different because he had that possibility within himself to be different. It's about here in his sermon on Jacob and the angel that Rabbi Volpe says this to his congregation. He says, if you're sitting in this congregation, you are among the 99.9-something percent of the luckiest people who ever lived. Even if your 401k is going down, that's still true. And here's why the members of Rabbi Volpe's congregation are the luckiest people in the world. It is, he says, because a religious worldview is an anti-deterministic worldview. A religious worldview, he says, is one that understands that though much about the world is given and is determined, ultimately what is not determined is a disposition of your soul. That is for you to decide. That is a choice you make. Think about it. He's right. Think about the many factors that go into making us who we are that are predetermined, either through our genes or through the DNA we inherit. Our height, our hair, or lack of it, our shoe size, our skin color, our birth order, whether we're prone to cavities or not, the circumstances of our families of origin, and to a certain extent, probably our IQ and maybe even personality factors. But what we also get as our birthright and as a blessing that no one can ever take from us is this ever-present possibility of renewal. What Rabbi Volpe tells his congregation is that the angel that Jacob struggled with that night was the angel of his better nature, and through the struggle, he received the blessing of self-transformation. You don't have to be Jacob anymore. You have struggled, and now you can change. It doesn't mean, the rabbi says, that bits of Jacob won't cling to you. They will. But now they are subsumed into something greater, something better, and something more beautiful. You may be wondering how I know so much about Rabbi Volpe's angel sermon. And I know about this sermon because Rabbi Volpe is Emma Forrest's rabbi. And Emma is the young writer who has spent so much of her life wrestling with too many dark nights of the soul. In her remarkable memoir called Your Voice in My Head, she writes of her lifelong struggle to be healthy and whole. And it was hearing that sermon at a Shabbat service that helped her turn her life around. Because what she heard and understood was that, like Jacob, she didn't have to be Emma the way she had been Emma in the past. She too had struggled mightily, and she too could change. She would always be Emma, like Jacob would always be Jacob, but she knew in her soul that the past did not have to determine the future, and she understood for the first time that it was possible that she would know and experience something greater, something better, something more beautiful. Read this book, my daughter told me one day this summer, and I did. And there on page 168 was my own Unitarian Universalist theology, my own understanding of the nature of God and of life itself and what it all means, right there in the story of Jacob and the angel as interpreted by a Jewish rabbi in the faraway land of Southern California. I'll confess to you that when I first read this sermon in Emma's memoir, I closed the book and I thought, oh man, how could someone be that good and write so well that his sermons change lives? But then I discovered through a quick internet search that Newsweek magazine has named Rabbi Volpe the best rabbi in the United States for 2012. And I felt better. Although it's hard to know whether this is urban legend or actual fact, but it's often said that the fastest way to lose your faith is to go to divinity school. But that's not always true, and it wasn't for me because it was in seminary that I learned about process theology, which is a philosophy that says everything is in relationship to everything else, and everything is always in the process of becoming. So what that means to me is that nothing is ever entirely new, but that every second of every moment brings space for the new, space for the different, space for change. Isn't that how life works? We honor the past, we learn from the past, but the future beckons us forward, providing just enough of an opening that the past cannot ever entirely determine the present. This week, 13 million Jews worldwide are being asked by their faith to take stock, to make amends, and begin again. It's what we do. The possibility in life's power of renewal is life's great gift to us every second of every moment of every day. I will close with one last story. Recently, Joe and I, Joanna, our dearie, realized that we have a friend in common, the Reverend Patrick O'Neill. Patrick was my mentor the year I was newly ordained and a brand new minister. That was the same year Joe was born. Really. But Patrick was also her minister in Framingham and her family's minister when she was growing up. Small world. Patrick grew up in quite a large family in what he describes as a crowded urban neighborhood in northern New Jersey. And one of the neighbors in his apartment building was an elderly French woman who gave piano lessons. One day when Patrick was in the first grade, a small gang of what he calls second grade thugs ganged up on him and pushed him down, face down in a snowbank. Righting himself, he began to cry tears of indignation and rage. Madame Boutillon had witnessed this injustice from her kitchen window, and she came downstairs and, taking young Patrick by the hand, she brought him into her apartment, made him a cup of hot cocoa, fussed over him in a way that helped make his world right again. She said to him, "Patrick, you are angry at those boys for what they did to you, and it's natural for you to feel that way, but now you must let it go. This day has other things to give you. It was years later that Patrick's sister, during one of her piano lessons, asked Madame about the number tattooed on her forearm. It was, she explained, her identification number from Auschwitz. And she told her young pupil that she often covered the number with long sleeves, not because she was embarrassed about it or didn't want people to know, but because being a concentration camp prisoner was a past identity, and it was not what she was anymore. It is life's blessing of renewal that allows us to say, this day has other things to give. So may it be. Amen. Our final hymn this morning is hymn number 219, O Hear My People.
This is a prayer called Sim Shalom, and Yukiko will be playing the postlude, a piece called Sim Shalom. And it means, grant peace, goodness, and blessing to the world, graciousness, kindness, and mercy to all. In the book of life and blessing, peace and prosperity, may we all be inscribed for a good and peaceful life. Please be seated.